because we're already talking. We're already into it. So basically saying hello to each other. Yeah, she's already, yeah, it's interesting in the last year, like how much the room, more than anything else, has changed.
Yeah, the evolution of that little girlness.
Yeah, so the photo of the fairies, or the painting of the fairies that Lizzie did, or the, you know, the cartoon of her and her sister, that's all. It's still in the room, but it's like on the windowsill, basically, and everything else is as, you know, cool as it can be. And wanted to rearrange the top of the shelves so it looked nicer and less messy. She still like spills sauce all over a bed and things like that, so that doesn't help.
The bed's always going to be the collateral damage, really.
No, so please don't eat that in your room. Okay. Spilled Milo on the sheets, is that okay? Can you wash my sheets? I spilled it. Yeah, that kind of stuff, so that's fun.
Yeah.
But speaking, well, we're right into it. It's Alison Hill. And you're an empty nester.
Yes.
So
yes. 26 years.
26 years.
Yeah. And the last 10 felt like I was living in a share house again.
Right.
But not actually, not as fun.
So what's that like? How long's it been? Has it been like a week, 2 weeks? How long?
It's been a week, formally. A week, maybe two.
Yeah.
Time goes fast when you can walk around naked in your own house.
Has that been the one difference? It's just way more naked?
Yeah, but yes, but it's not as titillating as it sounds. Ha, no. Ha, ha. It's more like, my undies are on the inside laundry, but it's up the other end of the house.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't actually have to put something on. I can just walk through and get them.
Oh, that sounds delightful.
I know it is. That's delightful. But it's funny, you know, it's I often said that the last child that was here, it was a lot like living with my dad when I was a teenager. And I left home at 17 because living with dad was just not working for me.
You mean like the atmosphere around the place, you mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The atmosphere was a bit, could be not tense exactly, just, you know, just a layer of disappointment sort of.
Right.
Just taints the air.
Right. Yeah. Where's the disappointment coming from in relationship with the child?
Oh,
still directed to
you? It's probably from both ends, but mostly from him. Not disappointment. I can't think of the other word that starts with dis that I want. Disapproval.
Right. Disapproval.
That's the word. Yeah. Disapproval. Yeah, totally. That's exactly what I mean.
So when you're walking around the house when you were 17, that was always the disapproval was always never far from the surface. Is that what you mean?
Oh, it was dense. Yeah, you had to wade through disapproval.
So what was the disapproval of?
Just not being the person that I was. I don't know. I wasn't controlled anymore at 17. Right. And I think that was part of it. That I'd been, you know, it was a very controlling. My dad's a complex man. It was a very controlling environment when I was there. He was sort of. If he'd had his way, we would never have been aged out of being 4 years old and cute, you know?
Right.
So starting to think for ourselves, well, in my case, starting to think for myself was a significant issue for a big challenge for him.
So was he one of the parents and, you know, we'd both worked in schools and you would see it from time to time. Was he like an infantilizer? Like did he... I don't know if that's the correct term, but did, you know, you see these parents who still talk to their children.
No.
Like they're younger than they are, not just to sort of keep them in that, you know, arrest development stage, I guess.
No, he wasn't like that. No, it was almost like a tiger mama.
Right.
You know, like when I was in high school, sometimes I love hearing about you and Violet because I think, oh, wow, that's a... It's novel to me. It what you're talking about when with your relationship changes
right.
is normal, but it's really novel from my own personal experience, because the older I got, the more controlling he got.
Right.
I was his eldest. So when I started high school, he had to pick all my classes for me. And in year 10, yeah, that was still the thing. So we'd have these ongoing battles about, it's an elective, I can choose electives. And he'd be going, well, I want you to do languages, or I want you to do science. And I'd be going, well, no, that's not going to happen. And in fact, he made me take French from all the way through. And in year 8, I'd sort of put my foot down, and that didn't ever go down well with him. And I said, if you make me do this, I will fail. I'll deliberately fail, which I did spectacularly.
So in the end, he said, no, you will do it and you will do well at French.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And so no wonder at 17 you were keen to get out.
Yeah.
So when you leave home at 17, do you have a bindle tied together on the end of a stick? Are you on it where you're like, like you couldn't have had too much to your name at 17?
No, I didn't have much. I don't know what we did. It's hard to remember now. I think they gave me some shitty furniture they didn't want anymore. So yeah. That was a help.
So yeah. when you said you were moving out, did that cause consternation?
We weren't speaking at that time.
Right. But they still gave you furniture.
Yeah, well, Mum was pretty keen to get rid of furniture.
Whatever it took.
Yeah.
Right. So you weren't speaking with your dad before you moved out. No. How long had that been going on?
Oh, probably a good 12 months finishing school.
Yeah. And so, like you said, now you're the empty nester, and apart from walking around nude, what's the air like? What's the feeling like of your day to day? How has that changed?
Oh, it's lovely. It's weird. There's echoes, you know. I keep feeling like there's still somebody living up the other end of the house, but it's nice. We don't get the pervasive pot smell anymore, and that's, you know, take it away, I suppose.
Yeah, fair enough.
The food doesn't go missing, so.
Yeah, there's no one to blame if the food's got missing.
Yeah, that's right.
Certainly cut down the numbers.
It's been very much like living in a share house.
Yeah.
With someone who's a little bit tedious to live with.
Right.
Yeah,
we've all done that. Just people who
that's right.
You don't speak to and you hardly ever see them, and then you're like,
Simon, of course, was saying, oh, you know, our solar panels are making more electricity than we're using.
Yes. When he says that to you, do you go, oh, okay. Have you learned that sound yet? Great.
Oh, I learned that years ago.
Yeah. So, yes, I'm sure I've already said to Charles, when we get solar panels, like, I will do my best to refrain from, check the readings of the solar. I'm doing an impersonation of someone here and I should stop doing it. Yeah. But yes, I should. Yes, the reading out of, look at this is how much energy we've used compared to what we've saved. Like, cool. How exciting.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of interesting, but I was just thinking, oh, yeah, we're going to save a fortune.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. So that must be nice. It must be nice to, I mean, I always joke about it with my girls, but I do look forward to it. It's my dad's fault. He was always, you know, fairly excited to get rid of us, but. You know, I've talked to him about, he said he had 5 years, I think, between the kids moving out, and 4 or 5 years where the kids moved out and the grandchildren arrived. So there was about a 4 or 5 year gap. And he said that was a pretty sweet run for 4 to 5 years. So that's all I'm looking forward to is.
Oh, totally. Well, I've been warned by older friends, you know, don't get too excited and too comfortable
with
the nakedness, because they come back again.
They come back, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, that's all right. I want, particularly this, the last child that's gone, I just want this to be successful for him because it'll be life-changing for him.
Yeah.
So I actually want him to be successful for himself, not for our comfort or whatever, but so that he can take that next step.
When do you think, like, that's, I mean, it's a very healthy attitude, but do you think that shifts at a certain age? I'm just noticing with my girls is that I didn't recognize it happening, but all of a sudden it's the success for themselves is starting to become way more important than like a milestone, for example, when they're babies. Oh well, they did this, they did that, isn't that great? But they don't care, like they're just getting about it. But now I'm noticing things like the way it's a little more subtle, like we talked about with Violet, the way she, what's the word? The way she sort of made it clear to her friends in year seven what she's willing to put up with. So here are my standards. Yes. So that kind of stuff is like she won't, and it's not in her report card. It's not, she doesn't think that's that important, but I can see it as, like, that's a real milestone that some people don't reach for a long time, and it might swing back the other way and things like that. But yeah. I wonder what age that becomes a difference, where you start looking at how important success is for them. That has very little impact on you.
And I think that's really that's pretty key, because when you were talking before about, you know, parents who infantilize.
Yeah.
So there's that being able to see your child make these leaps and going, oh, that's excellent. They're working, taking tiny steps towards eventual autonomy and eventual adulthood.
Yeah.
But I find it really hard to imagine that there are parents out there who that's actually a real problem for them.
Right. To actually.
In my dad's case, he had to try to control the situation because he needed to be, you know, the father, and this is it was a very much patriarchal household.
Right.
You know, I need to squash all this autonomy and this independent thinking. And like you say, other parents baby their children to maintain that control as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to being a teacher of her age group and seeing what the students who, you know, I don't know about thrive, but the students who do well in terms of, again, I don't even know, I guess in terms of character, because it's not, oh, this helps them have better friends, because it doesn't. But in terms of character, the students who learn to say, well, I'm not going to put up with that. That's not part of me. They're the students who, I don't know, are succeeding, well, I guess.
Boundary setting, right?
Say that again?
Boundary setting.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can see, oh, that makes a bigger difference to their day-to-day life, even if it excludes them from their peers, because nobody wants a boundary setter in year seven. That's not what we want around here. We want no boundaries. We want intensity, and we want changeability, I guess.
And drama.
And drama.
Yeah. Ah,
love the drama. She actually said today, like, I think my friend just was bored today and wanted to start some drama. I was like, yeah, that's what people do when they're bored.
Yeah, and that's really good if you can spot it.
Yeah. Now, did you do your work? No. Oh, okay, whatever. It's nearly the end of the year, whatever.
Did you get sucked in? Totally.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, no, I argued with them. Yes, it was important. What's better, like a Samsung phone or an Apple phone? Like, that needed to turn into drama.
that's
kind of how it goes, isn't it? All right. Yeah, well, again, I don't know how long we've been talking, and why would we ever know? I haven't even got to why we're here. Why are we here? So I've got a few things, because I have my little notes here of what's it called? It's called Things We Come Up With Coffee and Alison.
yeah.
So I've got a couple of questions to ask you that I'm always happy to talk about. The question one you asked me just randomly last time we had last time or the time before, you said, is like music like the best invention ever or something like that? Now, has that been something you mulled over or it just popped into your head or?
Oh, that was probably a late night thinking thing. You know how you adjust the soundtrack? There's things that you can do, and now we've got this wonderful technology, which means you can just stick earbuds in and you've got your soundtrack to whatever it is that you're doing, and it inevitably makes everything much sweeter.
Yeah.
Just thought, middle of the night musings, isn't it? It's probably the best thing that mankind's ever done, really, right?
Humankind, thank you, Alison.
Shit, you.
And I took that to human. Let's talk about whom. What it means to be humans.
A human.
I think, well, I took that question immediately to students.
Oh.
Because I like, because I'm always talking to them about music, how important it is to share music. We recently had our last lesson with the year 12s, and one of the things I talked about was the lesson or wisdom I can impart on you is don't be a dick about music.
Totally.
Which is just, and I explained to them, which is from my own experience of being a dick about music. You know, like, if someone's enjoying something, why do you want to take that away? Why do you want them to enjoy something less that's got no impact on you? Yeah. Mainly because it's really popular or it's beneath your standards of what real music is or something like that. Just being a wanker about music, really. So I've always talked to them about that and why music's great. And we talked about, even at the start of the year, I ask them to give me songs randomly and it's anonymous. And then throughout the year, I'll be like, give me a song that's good to listen to when you're sad. Give me a song that's makes you dance every time, like all of that stuff. And you always find the songs that they tell you at the start of the year are really generic and safe. Even though it's anonymous, there's still this worry that
hedging their bets.
Yeah, that they're going to be judged on music. Yeah. Like I'll go, all right, here's the list. Wrong, 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 which is what I would have done as like at their age. I would have rolled my eyes and, oh my God, that song, whatever. You think that's music? Well, yeah, all that wanky stuff. But then that's what we talked about was that, once you get comfortable with people and you start sharing your music, then people share, if you like this music, then you're like, about this music. Or you're not afraid to be like, I heard this song, what's that song? And as you said, now we have technology where we can be sitting in a cafe where we've done and we've stopped the conversation to either go, oh, I like this song. Like the other day when we were listening to The Doors came on, I was like, oh, I know this for ages. Fantastic. Yes. Or in the past where I'm like, all right, stop. And, try to put Shazam or whatever app is to find out what that song is. And now you've got a song that you like.
God, I love Shazam. Shazam is the best.
Yeah. Just something, you can just do it on Google and just, is it a song? Let me have a listen. Like, it just makes, like, number one, stops you from, what's this song called again? I don't know. But you can say if something catches your ear, which is always great when a new song catches your ear, you just can have it. Anyway, we're all over the shop as always. But what I did ask the students, what's a better invention than music? And they were like, I'm sure heaps of things. And I'm like, okay, name them. So I think the best argument that people came up with was medicine. But that was the only one. Someone said cars, airplanes. And I was like, I haven't been on a plane for a long time.
No.
For a number of years. But if you told me 3 years since I've been on a plane, if you told me you can't listen to music for 3 years, I'd be pretty bummed out about that.
And you know what? This is a true thing. As soon as you mention planes, the first thing I think of is Radiohead.
Yeah.
Because it's what I listen to when I'm on planes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And in airports, if I'm waiting in airport lines, that's what I'm listening to.
Well, any particular album or?
Look, I couldn't tell you. I just hit shuffle and I go.
Well, yeah. I remember listening to them a lot, traveling as well. Good traveling music on buses and planes around Europe and all that stuff. And then I remember reading an article about, or an interview with Thom Yorke where he said like, oh yeah, that album I think is good to listen to on the move. And I was like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you just hit shuffle. Why do you think let's just talk about Radiohead. Why do you think Radiohead at the airport, or is it just that's what matches what you're seeing around you, or?
Actually, there's probably something about the disparity of what's around you. You know, you're not in your own environment. You're in, even if you travel heaps, you can be standing in the queue at the airport for customs or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And it might be a familiar thing that you're doing, but it's never the same as another time you did it.
Right.
The people, the faces are all around you are really different, and there's, you know, different, you just, I don't know. It lets me go right inside and I can really just sit there and I can people watch pretty innocently.
Yeah, there's a lot of humanity at an airport, isn't
there? There's a lot of humanity, and I love it. It actually, yeah, it just gets me out of my head a bit, which I like.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because you just see that person looks like they've been traveling for days. Yeah. Oh, that person's got a young child. That's not going well.
That's exactly right. And at the same time, I've got the disparity of the music of Radiohead itself actually fits it really well, and yet it's really familiar. So, you know, I've got that touchstone.
Yes, it's very comforting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. So music beats medicine?
I mean, music is medicine a bit, isn't it?
What a great sentence might be the title of this episode. Yeah, it is, right? It's comforting. It can lower your heart rate. It can de-stress you. Yeah. It can...
And you can pick it, you know, you're not just subjected to it. You can go, this is where I am now. This is what I need to, you know, I need to have a cry. I need to listen to sad songs or whatever, or I need uplifting and I need some motivation.
Isn't it interesting though, like that maybe it's not so common, but I have a feeling it is, which is when you're sad, you want to listen to sad songs.
Yeah.
But if your friend's sad, you don't want to make them sadder. No, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, why don't, maybe we should just try and make our friends really sad when they're already sad.
Yeah.
I've never thought of that before, but why don't we do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you feeling sad, are you? Well, let's try and make you sadder. I'll tell you some more sad stories.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's wring every last drop out.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing's better. Nothing better than a good maudlin song on a rainy day. And again, like the...
There's maudlin, but there's just moody and broody.
Yeah.
You know.
Moody and broody. You're coming up with some good titles. There's no doubt about it.
Moody and broody might be my... that
could be your autobiography. State, actually. Well, I mean... It's sort of fitting too, because as we're recording this, the light is fading in both our rooms, so it is getting quite moody and broody. Although I can see in my camera it's still light, but my window faces, yours must be sort of more enclosed. But anyway, so yes, we're getting quite moody and broody in here. So I mean, it's a difficult question to ask, but or to answer. Can you remember that feeling as a kid, beyond like I love this music and whatever, but can you remember that feeling or that discovery that of what music can do to you, rather than, like you said, you're subjected to it, especially when you're younger, but can you remember just going, oh, this is so helpful?
One of my earliest memories is waking up late at night and the house is dark except for the lounge room. There's one lamp on in the lounge room, and my dad's there reading, and he's got like a glass of probably scotch with ice, so I can hear the ice cubes, and he's got jazz on really low. That was one of the most reassuring memories I've got, and one of the nicest memories I've actually got of him. Just, you know, listening to that clinking and that really just very not too hectic, just deep, low jazz.
Right.
The volume of it and the nighttime and all that sort of stuff. I still love that. I've spent years trying to, or not trying, but years replicating that moodiness of a certain time of night, certain time of year, especially Christmas time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was
really a comfort. It's a comfort thing.
Yeah. And you said you tried to recreate it. Does it work just as well, or does it have to be a bit more organic?
It does work, but I have noticed, you know, like when we've been out to dinner or we've had people over and it's late at night and that happens, I actually I think, oh, you can all go home now because I'm enjoying this moment.
100%. 100%. We've had parties here where I have been doing the party's still going and I'm doing the washing up.
Yeah.
Listening to songs on the headphones and just really whatever I want to listen to this and then putting it on and just going, oh, this is pretty great. And then just like, oh, the party's still going on, whatever. People are like, you don't have to do the washing up. And you're like, I'm having a party. Don't worry about it. This is great. Found the music that matches your mood is always fantastic, especially when it's random, especially when it's completely random. Yeah. And you're like.
And it's like everything syncs nicely in the world. For that very small moment, you're completely in sync with everything.
Yeah, that's a great feeling, isn't it? Where
It is. It's a brilliant feeling. I'd love to be able to bottle that and or figure out the exact equation and make that be 9/8 of the day.
9/8 of the day. Right. Okay. Really cram that in there. Yeah, it is. It is. When you're listening and it becomes like soundtrack of your life, and you're just like, oh, fantastic. I mean, Radiohead is a winner as well. Traveling on a bullet train in out of Tokyo listening to Kid A is it's one of those things where you're like, how did they know I was going to be here on this train at this moment? Which is syncing up with everything I'm feeling and seeing and all of that stuff. Yeah. No, I think you're right. It's the best invention.
I think
music and then having it recorded, that's a big step in evolution, I reckon, having recorded music, music you can listen to whenever you want.
I wonder what it did to our brains.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was like, I wonder what it did if you mapped out when music, the stages of music, when you could listen to a recording, when you could listen to a live recording rather than a studio recording, whether you could, when you could listen to radio, when you could, when rock and roll started, like all of those changes in society, how much was music to the forefront? And I'm not really sure. I mean, the Beatles documentary just came out, Get Back just came out. And I'm always, and it's always interesting when the Beatles are written about.
How many times have you watched it?
Well, just once, it's 8 hours long, but I will. I know already that it's something that I'll put on in the background, like if I'm doing a lot of marking or, you know, it's that time of year where I need something on in the background that I can just have as a comfort, I will be watching that. But the Beatles are always written about in such a way where their music sort of led the culture.
Yeah.
Very rarely them reacting to a movement. But I don't know if that's looking back, people, you know, placing that or fitting that into a nice narrative, but it always seemed like they were making music and then society
caught on
and copied whatever they did, which is unbelievable to this day. I still don't know how that happened, But again, it just proves that it's the best.
Do you think about that a lot?
About what, whether they leave?
It never occurred to me before, but now I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, you know, was it the very different talents all brought together in a singular moment?
You mean like, do I think about how it worked?
How they did it?
Well, I mean, I do. I think the thing that helped them do what they did more than anything else was when they went to Hamburg, and they played in Hamburg for a few months, but they played 8 hours a night. And so they played 8 hours a night. You can't just go through the motions.
No, that's serious practice, isn't it?
And it's serious energy, and they're on a lot of amphetamines. 10,000
hours of practice.
Yes, that's right. And they did that in a condensed period of time. I mean, it's just luck that they all – I mean, the reason why they're the most successful or most famous band is because, like, it works, and that's just what happens with bands, is that people fit together and it just works. So John and Paul just fit together, and they wrote together, and they – just work together. Even watching the documentary, there's just so many times where you can just they're just trying things out, and when they get it, then they know. And they don't waste, there's no like, oh, there's like 55 songs that they never released. They just don't waste it. They just go, nah, that's not working, bin it, doing that, or we'll keep working on it until that one works. And so I don't, there's no equation or something to work that out of how it worked, but the just having that condensed period of time, because it's spoken about, they played in Liverpool, they were okay, they went to Hamburg for a few months and just came back completely different, new image, new attitude, hundreds and hundreds of songs in their repertoire that they'd learned to play on a regular basis. They had all of that bass in a really quick time, and they had the energy. I think the first few albums are immediately like, oh, let's try and do something different. And again, in the Get Back documentary, the amount of times they were like, nah, they play something that sounded really good, and they're like, that sounds too much like this thing we did 8 years ago, or that sounds a bit like, is that too much like, and then they play that riff, and they'd be like, oh, that sounds like this song, and they, well, let's play it. And then they play the other song, not from them, but from another artist, and they'd be like, yeah, it does sound a bit. So they were constantly trying to change. But I think you go a bit mad trying to work out just how, let's put them all together. And that's kind of what people have done cynically with like making boy bands, I guess, is let's just look at their image first. We'll get the image first, and then we'll hope.
But there's a lot of it. So this is... there was a lot of external influence for boy bands, like boy bands in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Hugely managed and structured externally.
But I think the Beatles were the same.
Really?
I was just about to
tell you, do you think it was because they were just such easygoing lads to a degree that they had the... you know, they sort of kicked off and went, oh yeah, they were just easygoing.
But if you have a look at them, like at the start of 1962 or something, where they're pretty rough, they got when they're 62 or 61, when their manager takes over, when Brian Epstein arrives, then he's like, we're all going to wear suits, and we're all going to wear a tie, and we're all going to play our song, and then at the end of it, bow. Like that was all completely managed. They were rough houses and big drinkers and just, you know, young people having a great time. And they were really, so the first album especially has that energy to it. But I think that was the difference, was they had this heavily cultivated image that they had the talent to break out of.
Oh, okay.
But that took a while. They were still like a... And you look at A Hard Day's Night, they've got this charm and humour and, you know, just this chemistry that's undeniable, just in music but also in just around each other. But they were still like a beat band until, you know, like they started getting to help. Once they sort of got into that mid stage, for the most part, they were still heavily, I think it was still heavily structured. They were allowed to be more creative musically than they were with their image. And then once they got really successful, then they could sort of do what they wanted.
Yeah.
So maybe that's when they started to like lead the culture, was like, well, we're not, you know, they listen to other stuff and then do a better version, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. There's a certain maturity in that.
Yeah. And again, like they broke up and they were like 28.
Yeah.
So like that's the other thing. George was 25 or something. So it was that kind of, they're young. They got all this energy. Let's try that. Let's try that. In your 20s, I think you tend to be like, let's try this. Should we try that? Yes. Let's do that.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think I've said it before on this podcast, and this will be the last we talk about it. I think that you can track sort of the Beatles' career is a lot like, I think, going through your 20s. Now, maybe that's just sort of to me is, you know, you have this sort of image of yourself when you're in your early 20s, and then you try and rebel against that image and you go as far away from that as possible, like they did Sgt. Pepper's and all this stuff, where they were like, we don't want to be the Beatles, we want to be bright and garish and all this stuff. And by the end of it, they sort of come back to like a more bluesy roots, just pure rock. I mean, it wasn't pure rock, but and I think in your 20s, I don't know, you sort of go through, I'm going to try this image. Oh, right, this is who I actually am. You know what? It's not too far away from who I am in my early 20s, but I sort of denied that. I wanted to be someone different for a long time, but you can't. You can't really deny it forever. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's just my theory.
Yeah, that works. I was going to say, I get it. I remember seeing friends do that. I had kids relatively young, so I think I had arrested development, and then maybe I did that in my late 30s, early 40s.
But right.
Yeah. I hear where you're coming from.
Yeah. I like to talk to you about how everyone loves a good narrative, so maybe that narrative just makes me fit with the Beatles. I don't think you need to look any further than that, really.
Oh, there you go.
Makes you go, oh, yeah. Well, that makes sense. Okay, so now the reason why I had you on this podcast was the other day we were talking, just changing the subject completely, and I was telling you a story about how I went out for dinner, and using the skills from this podcast of listening, even though I've talked a lot. I always talk too much. That I started, you know, having conversations with these parents that I really haven't spoken to all year while Noel played soccer, and actually talking to them and finding out one of the parents was a midwife and really just asking very specific questions. Tell me about the first birth that you were at. Tell me about how you debrief. Tell me about like how you get through the really low points of delivering children, obviously. And all of that stuff. And she was just talking to me in depth. It was a fantastic conversation. But then I asked the guy next to her a similar question, and it was only afterwards that I realized he didn't really answer any question that was asked of him. He just sort of had stories and pre-prepared stories, basically. But I didn't realize at the time, because a good story is a good story, and you're like, oh, yeah. But then I realized later, he didn't actually answer the question. So he just had stories that sounded like now, like go-to stories.
Yeah.
So I said to you that like men, maybe that men aren't so much into conversation, that they just like telling stories. And you gave me a look that I guess could be described as "der Fred." Is that the phrase?
Der Fred.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So is that you'd obviously had that observation, or it's something you were aware of?
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
So do you have a theory? Oh, there you are. Alison was completely in the dark. You look like Kurtz from Apocalypse Now, just sitting in the dark. Who does your lighting? But is it something, why do you think that is? Why do you think men are and again, it's a generalization, but that men tell stories, but women just have conversations.
I think, well, I don't know. Like, I mean, you could get back to the cavemen. I don't know. I think that telling stories is that man thing to do. That's how you engage with each other. It's not a, I don't know. I see less give and take when my male friends would tell stories and they'd encourage each other. They would have heard the story, you know, but they would encourage each other and they'd set each other up to tell the story. And it would be beautiful. It would be, you know, just curated perfectly.
Yeah.
And depending on the audience, there'd be people who were supposed to laugh at the right times and make the odd comment and all that sort of stuff. That's just what guys do. And you listen to each other and, you know, and then you, I'll top that kind of thing. So that's what it is. It's a parcel of information, a parcel of, you know, this is the situation and this is what happened and blah, blah. And that's how you do these things, showing stuff.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing you said about, like, well, I can top that, you know, I've got well, here's a story that's the same. And sometimes I have to like really be on self-aware to like stop that, you know, like maybe just listen to the people rather than wait for them to stop talking. So then you can tell your amazing story.
Yeah. But that's a real guy thing.
Yeah. And sometimes one thing I'm really working on is letting go when the story goes away. You know, like you're in the middle of a story and then someone jumps in and then it disappears and the conversation goes elsewhere. I often would try and bring it back to
where you were,
where I was.
Yeah.
But that was just so I could tell my story. It had nothing to do with like the natural conversation. Yeah. And it wasn't like, what were you? How did we get on to that topic? Well, it wasn't that. It was just, no, you have to hear the end of the story. It's good.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I haven't gotten to the punchline yet.
No. And you'll like it. Yes. And therefore you'll like me. Yeah. It's interesting you say that about curated. If you do some maths in my head, if you go back two episodes to an episode you haven't heard yet, with Craig, I did with Craig and Wigo, that is exactly what you're talking about. All Wigo and I did was ask Craig, tell us about this story, tell this story, tell that story, because he has great stories. And most of them I was there for.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You know the story.
And I know the story, but it's a joy to hear. Enjoyment of
hearing the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his stories are really good because there's very little embellishment. He just happens to be someone who crazy stories happen to when he's around, or fun stories happen when he's around. Singular stories, I guess. They don't have to be like wildly funny, but they're certainly very singular. So you're right. You sort of have these curated stories. But when I think about it, if I think about like Justine and what story she has, there's not many. There's a lot around her family and things like that. But she doesn't have like, oh, this will knock them dead in the aisles. This is a funny story about.
No. And I think I raised this with you when we were talking the other day that some podcasts that you and I had done before, you had said to me, oh, what's the story that you've told the most, or what's your most popular story, or you know, something like that, something along those lines. And I was thinking, what the hell are you talking about? I think I was very quiet for a few seconds, which is rare. And I was scratching my head thinking, I've got no fucking idea. I don't have a favorite story that I'm asked for, or like that's not a part of my thing.
Yeah.
I just have a lot of stories, but they're dependent on the situation.
Yeah, they're organic, not just...
They're organic. Yeah, that's right. They come up in conversation. It's not a... And it really set me on my ass when you said, oh, you know, I thought I've got nothing to tell you.
But that's true. Like, that's the thing. It's organic, whereas what this guy did at this dinner is what I would do as well, was like, oh, well, I've got a story. I would say, well, I'm a teacher, but let me tell you some funny stories that kids do, or anything like that, then you would have these stories. But it's not it's not
And if I was going to that dinner, I would be in the same pain as I'm sure that you were in going to it. But in my head, I would have thought, what are some questions, what are some things I can ask people? I wouldn't have gone in with anything prepared other than what are things I can ask people, you know, what can I ask Billy's mum or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah, because as soon as you find that one thing to latch onto, again, that's the thing that I have to be mindful of is, just ask questions. Don't say, well, that reminds me of what happened to me. You just say, okay, so all right.
Although I do love it when somebody else does that. Do tell.
Yeah, and it depends what the story's about. If you've like, let me tell you about the time I pooped myself. Everyone gathers around for that. Everyone's got a story like that.
You betcha.
Yeah.
I didn't know that everybody had a story about like that. I think that was
Yeah, well, I mean, talk about.
Very pleased to hear that comment.
Talk about curation. If Justine's around, she'll prod me to tell the story. Like any story, I have a few stories that she makes me tell her. And they all involve me at my lowest point. Like that's what makes her, you know, that's the.
And, you know, there's something to be said for people who are completely transparent.
Yeah.
You know, who would just go, oh, yeah, this thing happened to me. It was really embarrassing. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
I love that. That's great. You've got me. I'll talk to you all night if you're happy to have those conversations.
Yeah, exactly right.
No problem at all.
But that's the thing is if you don't like small talk, then you've got to work out when do you fire off that question. Like I'm going to ask a very direct pointed question here. And I wonder, I'm going to pay attention in future to how men respond to a very direct question, whether they get uncomfortable or discombobulated immediately because it's not in their Rolodex of amusing stories about me.
Yes.
Or, you know, whether it just depends on how good the question is, I guess.
Yeah.
Because, a good question. It's like music, really. It's medicine. Anyway. Anyway, that was bad. You also said that women were practiced at not being listened to.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So
yeah, men are much more practiced at having that pat, having the story.
Yeah,
and then women, particularly men, don't have the patience to listen to women's stories. I don't think, or their voices get drowned out.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Is it just that's?
I mean, I can get on my same.
Please.
Patriarchy, it's the patriarchy. It's just, you know, it's.
We listen to male orators. Oh, man talking, gather round, that kind of thing.
That's right. That's right. Diminish the importance of women's experiences and inflate the importance of men's. Yeah.
Have you ever seen someone? Like a couple where the man has come over the top of the woman. You're telling the story wrong. Let me tell the story.
Yes, absolutely. But I've seen more, and I was thinking about this the other night. One thing that I've seen women do that I don't ever see men do, but it upsets me when I see it, and it upsets and frustrates me, is when having a conversation with a woman who has a male in earshot, her male in earshot.
Right, yeah.
And she checks all the details with him.
Oh.
You know, so I went out the other day. What day was it, sweetheart? Oh, was it Thursday? Oh, yeah, I went out on a Thursday and I was going to this thing and, what was I supposed to, how much money was it supposed to cost? What was that in doing all of that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I've seen the other side of it where they're telling the story and the partner's correcting them.
Yes.
Correct. And correcting them, isn't that like soul destroying when you're like, that's not important. Who cares? It wasn't a Wednesday.
Exactly.
It was a Friday. Cool. That's important.
Yeah. And I do see, I wonder if it's generational because I do see a lot of older people doing it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's I'm starting to lose my marbles and I need to touch base.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of women who do it who are young people.
Right.
And it's that, I think, are you trying to include your partner in the conversation and he may or may not be interested? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Or I don't know it and I don't get it. I find it uncomfortable.
Yes, it's uncomfortable for everyone.
Yeah, and it's not a story. It's not
certainly not a good story. If you're reading that in a book and it was like, hang on, just go and ask someone.
Yeah, that's right. But you remember the other day we were reading the same book and you said if a male author had written this, yeah, the amount of detail they've put in would be really tedious.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to extrapolate.
Well, that in what book was it? In Sally Rooney's late newest book, Beautiful World, Where Are You? One of the characters is an author, which is always a classic male literary figures story to be like, and the struggling author, painfully shy.
Yes.
Lots of women want to have sex with him, that kind of thing. strangely enough. Because of his depth and what he sees and his ability to see the truth in the world made him irresistible to women. Yes, his sensitivity. Yes. But one of the characters in it is an author, and so some of it is narrative, like omniscient, you know, someone observing the whole story. And then interspersed are basically these email correspondence where these two friends are sounding off on whatever occurs to them in an email and sending it out. But it's clearly the author's voice.
You know?
Author voice versus character voice is annoying when it happens in a book where you're reading this character and then all of a sudden you're like, now you've changed. This is what the author thinks. And it's very clear. The author's just, right. You know, the character's just saying what the author thinks, not what the character thinks, which, again, must be hard to do as a writer, you know, to write in someone else's voice and always be consistent. But I would have probably, it would have annoyed me more if it was a male writer, because when that happens, when the male voice enters in, or the author voice enters in a book written by a male, it's often, here is everything I know about the world. Here are my opinions on the world.
Certainties.
Certainties. Yeah. Oh, this is what I've observed. And it's accurate and pointed, and you will all go, yes, well observed, man, like that kind of thing. Whereas in this book, the characters themselves are making these observations, but there's still this genuine uncertainty about whether they're even right. Now, and that's what I mean. That doesn't often happen, you know, when the male author's voice enters in. It's usually with certainty. This is my theory. And mull over this. What do you think about this one? You see it on like in stand-up as well, in stand-up comedy, where you're like, someone's got this theory. And so it's the least funny part of the comedian is of their act is when all of a sudden they're talking about a theory where you're like, oh, that's interesting. And then they're just convincing and you're like, okay, is this still the comedian? Like again, or is it you're not the comedian anymore? You're you telling me how clever you are. It's the same in the author. That's what the author's doing. But in this case, it was, I don't think I've seen that where the author intrudes, but they're still like, this is what I think, but I mean, I don't know if it's right or not, or I could be completely
It feels weird to say it.
And they hedge what they're saying a little bit and sort of step back. Oh, no, I've said to him, I've gone too far there. And, you know, comment on maybe they're just tired or that kind of thing is very different. So that's certainly what I meant there was just especially in books is that's the, really yeah, the first totally. Time where I was like, oh, I don't like this at all. Like I didn't like the conceit because it was the author just get ranting about stuff, but it still had that authenticity to it rather than a pontification on everything I know, child.
And confidence, yeah. Now, can we take a step sideways because you raised something and made me think?
Yeah, yep.
I'm sorry, that's unprecedented.
me saying something or you thinking?
No, stepping sideways.
Oh, stepping sideways, okay.
I know that with comedians, a lot of women, female comedians are really having their, they're really stepping in and stepping up now.
Yeah.
But I know that that has been a struggle for a long time. And tell me why that is.
Why it's been a struggle for women in comedy?
Yeah.
Because every time.
This is all linked. This is all linked up.
Because every time a woman gets on stage, there will be a think piece written about why women aren't funny.
Women aren't funny.
Women aren't funny, or it's...
And who says it? Who's saying women aren't
funny? Men, of course, are saying women aren't funny. But yeah. They also, and I heard it on a podcast with Ellie Kemper, who's from The Office and Kimmy Schmidt and was in Bridesmaids. She said the amount of, like, bros that would say to her after Bridesmaids came out was, like trying to convince her that the movie was funny, even though it was all girls.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like it wasn't even a backhanded compliment. They were just oblivious to be like, I actually like that movie. Like, that's how they would say it. Oh, you're in Bridesmaid. Oh, you know what? I actually liked it. Even though it was just about girls.
Like,
and it's the same kind of thing as these discussions have to happen. Why is there a discussion that needs to be like, see? Like, what is that all about? And again, like was Lucille Ball not funny? Like, that's what I don't understand.
Yeah.
It's not like there haven't been, she was in a show with Desi Arnaz who can't act.
Who wasn't funny.
Who was not funny and couldn't really sing, played some maracas and bongos. But she was the star and she was the hilarious, like, I don't understand why they're like, oh, yeah, no, you know what? These women comedians are having their day in the sun and, it's often been difficult for them. And you're like, how is... Anyway, but that's why? Usually what it is.
You know, why? Why is it being difficult? That's it's even down to, women's fiction.
Right. Is it about, what do you mean about women's fiction?
Women, well, you know, we're still on telling stories and.
Do you mean that women's fiction is only for women, right? Like, it's the same thing of like, you know what, I enjoyed that female book.
Well, we have a whole genre, it's chick lit and it's chick diminished.
It's chick flicks and it's chick lit and it's date movies. That's coded for women will like it and drag your man along to begrudgingly watch this movie.
That's right. So that's what I mean, that it's all it's diminished, you know, that it's not as worth. Has less worth.
Well, I mean, I don't know, Alison, you'll have to show me some more evidence about this before I agree with you. I like to look at facts rather than, you know, emotions,
especially men facts.
Yes, I like to look at facts.
Phallic facts.
Where's my encyclopedias from 1943?
Where's my bar graph?
Women's comedy versus men's comedy. As we can see here, women like a chuckle and men like to tell stories. All right, well, we might wrap that up on that lovely note. I think we worked out some things there. Always a pleasure, Alison.
Always.
And that's it.